Welcome to Life Lab with David Ponder and Zach Schaefer. We are the podcast of Experience Experiments.
We give you those experiments via change challenges at the end of each episode.
We created this podcast because we wanted to talk about important topics that can help us all live meaningful lives.
You might agree with what we have to say, or you might disagree. But the point there is that you get something new to think about.
There's no edits and no gimmicks. Our entire point is to help you take action and live a better life.
You only get one life to live, so you may as well make the most of it. Hello, I'm David Ponder.
I'm Zach Schaefer.
Welcome to Life Lab. It's a beautiful Saturday morning here. We're into summer now, but it's not a normal summer. We're dealing with some things in our country, and I think that the topic that we're going to talk about today probably will touch on a few of those. The topic that we're talking about is something that is inevitable when you have opposing forces. We're talking about resistance.
Yeah, it was coincidental that that was just in our topic lineup, but that's what was popped up for today.
So when we talk about resistance, you know, like usual, we can start with a definition.
Sure.
If you're fine with that. So the definition of resistance is basically the opposition offered by a body or substance to the passage through it. That's a physical term for it. This is one of the longest definitions that I've ever seen because it can be defined in multiple different ways. They talk about an organism resisting harmful influence like disease or whatever. They talk about opposing and retarding forces. They talk about psychological defense mechanism where a patient rejects therapeutic efforts of a psychotherapist. So apparently the word resistance is applied in quite different ways.
Yeah.
But I would say at its basic, resistance is like impeding the progress of something.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good.
Okay.
Absolutely. And we can talk about, I think we're going to spend time talking about the unrest and protests and violence unfolding in the U.S. from the George Floyd murder. But I mean, that's, I think we should get to that because we can probably knock out some less important things. And just even saying that sounds weird because one of those things is COVID. It's only less important because the news cycle now is got the other thing playing. But
correct.
Resistance is huge with that because in terms of the ability to not be affected by something, right? Antibodies. Do you have resistance? Oh, his body or his mind has resistance to this. And clearly our country is trying to build up resistance to COVID so that we can try to get back to work and back to lives as normal. But obviously there's lots of other types of resistance and they start much younger in a human's life. And the first one is just general resistance to authority and being controlled. And I see that with my kids, you know, just when they're nothing, my kids, just kids, they resist being coerced or controlled or manipulated into doing things in socially adult, normal, acceptable ways. They want freedom. They just want to do and be and get out there. And that is not the society we've built because that's not what order is and that's not predictability.
You know what it is? It's testing. It is testing the social hierarchy of the home.
Yeah.
Kids have to see who's in charge. And they do a very good job of probing for weakness. It's like in Jurassic Park.
Right.
When the electric fences go down, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
they remember.
Yeah. But I think that's a really good point to say resistance of that sort exists everywhere. And it tests systems and it breaks down. It actually makes me think of there's a really great series of videos that I think everyone should probably watch. They're called Principles by Ray Dalio. And he just talks about some certain principles that he believes are ubiquitous to the universe, really. And he says that everything is made up of systems. And these systems operate in a cycle type fashion, a circular fashion, where they perform the same activity over and over again, and the different parts make up the system. But each system has a finite lifespan. It breaks down, and those parts become other systems. He's like, it's just kind of a law of the universe. I think that resistance, it probably helps in that process to determine when a system needs to break down.
I would say resistance in that metaphor, for me, what popped into my head, and I don't know if this is agreeing or disagreeing or a different point than you just made. Resistance would be almost like a law of nature that affects all the systems that Dalio or anyone that thinks about the world sort of in an interconnected way. It would be more like a law of the universe. Like, it'd be more like gravity. It's just a thing that exists in all systems.
I agree. Like,
but at different levels and different types of resistance.
And so you can talk about it specifically like an electric. I believe ohms are how they measure resistance of an electrical current to travel through a conductor. I could totally be wrong about that, but I think that's true.
Sure.
But that's just a very good example of resistance. I think every system has resistance built into it in some form or fashion, right? Like whether it be drag on an airplane or whether it be, you know, just difficulties for a systemized process, like weaknesses, the failure points, natural friction, right? So like when I talk about this in business, I always talk about how we want to design these things that we have that we're trying to accomplish to have minimal friction. So I think resistance is a natural piece of everything, like you said, every system. And that's why I think it's ubiquitous. Like, systems are ubiquitous, resistance is ubiquitous.
Yeah, but I also – you can flip it. Like, and I'm sure there's a different name for this, but resistance flips as soon as the actor and the receiver sort of switch roles. And I can give a concrete example. We took our kids last night to this drive-in concert / movie series that St. Louis was putting on. Really cool. A lot of fun. You pull your car in and, you know, with COVID going on and you've got a couple parking spots and you can unload and hang out and dance around. And Ben, my youngest, my 3-year-old, it was cool because at first the kids, it was their first concert type thing. And they were like, whoa, you know, they're looking around. They're like, this is crazy. And we're not uncomfortable, but they didn't want to like get out and start dancing as much. And then that just changed. And then they were insane. And he kept throwing this stupid stuffed animal up in the air. And there's, you know, there's people kind of close and he's running in circles. And so he's trying to be free. That's freedom. Like, he wasn't doing it at first to resist me. But once I noticed and then gave the order, if you will, or whatever, being like, okay, you know, we don't want to impede on other people enjoying this. Then it switched to, okay, motherfucker, I'm resisting you, because then I could just see in his eye contact and how he'd do stuff. But the flip of that is I was resisting his freedom, right? I'm sure there's a better word, but I was resisting his joy and what he was trying to do because
here's what I would verbalize it as. You have a system of authority, family authority, that is in place. It is a system that operates, and it doesn't operate in some instances. It breaks down.
Right.
It has failure points. And you were trying to make sure that that system operated correctly. He was resisting that system and trying to break it down, or at least flip it.
Right.
Flip the way that it worked, right? To build a different system in which he has control.
Yeah. Yeah. And the system I was thinking of was impeding on other people's enjoyment experience of the event. And I thought in the moment, I'm like, am I just scared of how others are judging me? And no, 0%. I didn't give a fuck. Like, he was having a good time. I just want to make sure other people can have a good time in that public setting. But that's another system.
Yes.
The public viewing exception or expectations and norms, he doesn't understand those. And he's too young for me to teach him that lesson. So that's what I had the concern of. I didn't care as much about the family system.
No, this is a perfect example. I love it because I can think of three competing systems in there. The public viewing system, mm-hmm. which he was, you know.
He's unaware of.
Yeah, messing with. The family authority system, which we discussed, and his autonomy, his personal autonomy system,
right?
Right? And those three were competing with each other.
Right. There's bubbles. There's systems, and they bump into each other. And that's what we're seeing with George Floyd, right? That's what we're seeing with some much bigger and more important systems, but they're bumping up, you know, groups of people. Well, we'll get to that. Well, let's get to that because that's going to be the most important piece.
Yep.
What else? Anything else you've got?
Yeah. So one of the parts of my definition talked about psychological defense mechanisms, right? Now, I didn't get too far into this with my research, but I do realize it's a thing. I've heard oftentimes you'll hear, you know, self-improvement gurus talk about self-limiting beliefs, right? I believe that's an instance of psychological resistance where for some reason we restrain ourselves from accomplishing or even just doing or experiencing things because of negative thoughts, emotions, fears that we have, usually thoughts about ourself that limit our capacity.
Yeah, our potential. Usually there's a fear of success down at that core, actually. And what that actually is a fear of responsibility and expectations. Once somebody achieves greatness, then it's like, oh my God, I can do great things. Now there's an now my floor and my expectation is raised, and now I better maintain this greatness or this excellence at all times. And that can be really scary for people.
And your responsibility, you know. The big hot thing everyone's watching, The Last Dance, about the 1998 Chicago Bulls on their historic last championship run, the sixth championship in 8 years, you know. They were kind of good. With it, it paints a picture of Michael Jordan that, you know, I'm sure if I would have sat down and thought about it, I'd have been like, oh, yeah, that's true. But you don't really think about what comes with that level of superstardom where he literally can't leave his hotel room. He's like,
what's your goal? What are you willing to give up,
man,
to like, get it? Everything.
In between practice and whatever, in between the press thing and the game, he literally has to go hide out. He just hides out in his room by himself and, you know, maybe he has one friend there with him. But while all the other guys can go do whatever it is that they want to do, he literally can't. It was interesting. So anyway, I thought that's a good example of what you're talking about with the responsibility that comes with success and therefore maybe having fear or wanting to limit yourself from that. That's really interesting. You know, the other thing about psychological resistance that I thought was interesting was talking about psychological resistance where it will actually, not in a bigger sense of being like, well, I don't want to achieve success, but literally not wanting to perform an action or not wanting to recognize something that might be true. The quote, here's our quote for resistance from me today. And this one comes from Upton St. Sinclair. And you've given this one a lot.
He's a fan of mine.
It just says
he's a fan of mine. I said, I'm a fan of his.
You're challenging
he's a
that.
Fan of mine.
You're challenging that.
Old Freud really jumped out there.
It said, you know, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding.
Oh, God. Repeat that slowly because people, we all fucking listen to this quote. It's important.
It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it.
I can say there's a whole bunch of stuff going on with COVID that ties into that. Some of these scientists do not want to grapple with data that doesn't fit their models and systems and metrics and training.
Every big issue goes back to your motivation, your incentives, right? If I'm incentivized not to believe something, like I get paid to make
to
the
have
other
a
case.
Paradigm that doesn't acknowledge this shadow area, this other area.
You know what? Here's a perfect place. This example just popped in my mind, and I think it's a perfect place where we might want to consider crossing over to talk about the turmoil in our country, and that is prosecution. And when I say prosecution, I'm referring to like a prosecuting attorney, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is their job to convict. That's their job.
Yeah, they represent the state
to do that, right? But they are given evidence to the entire case. to make their case.
Yeah, what's that, discovery?
Yes. So I would say this is a perfect example of someone's salary being dependent on them understanding something. And their understanding has to come to he is guilty. Has to.
Yeah.
So if they review the evidence and there's doubt in their mind, right? Like if they put themselves as a juror and then be like, oh, I don't know if this guy actually did it. They have to eliminate that. They cannot accept that.
That's actually their best tool.
Okay.
To think through, in my opinion.
Right, right.
Your best tool would be right. Your own personal doubt. And then thinking about audience-centered from the jury's perspective. What is my typical demographic makeup of my jury in whatever town you're in? If you are part of whatever that demographic makeup is, your strongest tool as a prosecutor is your own FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Because then you can interrogate that to build better stories around your case.
So you start off and you go, how do I convince myself that this guy is guilty, right? And then reviewing the evidence, oh, well, I have to ignore this. I have to ignore this. I have to ignore this. I have to focus on this. I have to focus on this. And then they either successfully convince themselves truly that this guy is guilty, or and then now they're going to push for his conviction. They're going to try to send this person to prison for as long as possible. Either that or, you know, even if they don't really believe it, they still have to try to send that guy to prison.
So in terms of resistance, they resist their individual feeling and prioritize what their job's mandate is above that.
Yeah, they resist a fair, unbalanced view. They resist a truly objective, you know, or...
But can humans be true?
Our
court system isn't objective. It tries to approach objectivity.
And I'm talking about this is a perfect example of that personal resistance where I would love – you can't do a study like this, but I would love to do a study where they took people, they presented them case evidence, and they said, look, if you can convince these people that this guy's – guilty and send him to prison, you can have some money. But if you review this evidence and you don't really think that he's, you know, guilty, then you just move on. You don't get any money. People are going to naturally be like, okay, I got to prove this guy's guilty because I want money.
Yeah, I like it. You're putting out a pretty controversial statement about prosecutors, but
I don't see how it's not true.
I think that they go into that. Their why has to do with justice. It has to do with I'm trying to do the right thing. And there are plenty of people who deserve to be put behind bars and have committed crimes and need to be prosecuted.
That's true. But also the
other thing is, though, in terms of attorneys, prosecutors don't make shit. When you work for the state, that's a shitty fucking job. Nobody wants to go. Most people don't. So the crusaders that do that, they're either really good at their job. Or they're doing it. I think for a while you could do it for 10 years, and then you could get your student loans paid off. So there's an incentive there, but you get paid nothing in terms of going into private practice. You can make way more money.
That's a good point.
And attorneys tend to be fairly financially motivated as a career group.
I know, and typically I think prosecuting attorneys are trying to bolster their chances for becoming.
It's a stair step, potentially.
Potentially. Yeah.
But there's plenty, though, that do care. Well, like, they're there for the justice.
That's true. You can use that exact same argument. So I took the prosecutor. Maybe it's more egregious if we use it on the side of the defense attorney.
Oh, they're the ones. They're like, you did it? Okay. Doesn't matter. Let's get you right there. I mean, really, let's get you off. Yes. Now, if I was going to be a defense attorney or a plaintiff's attorney or a prosecutor, 100% I'm a defense attorney. But, you know, that's just – I've always been a defensive person, and I can resist that thought and then build a system of beliefs and emotions around it and then persuade others of that.
So I wonder what that does to your mind when you get outside of the courtroom. I wonder if you're a really great defense attorney and you just – you develop a habit of convincing yourself that the truth isn't true.
Yeah,
you probably get really efficient at it, right?
Yeah, well, they're just super argumentative people. Do you not? I mean, I know a couple of defense attorneys that are very top notch. I don't enjoy speaking with them, to be honest, because everything's an argument. Like, they don't stop everything. They're going to come back until you agree with them, or they silence you, basically.
Yeah. Like I said, they become really efficient mm-hmm. at that, right? Yep. And so
it's rationalization. But it's also within the system we've built. And so I think, go ahead. I was just going to say, we need to resist and interrogate some of the systems we've built because they get outdated.
Well, yeah, and I wanted to expand that. So we've talked about things that you literally tie a paycheck to. This quote is about your salary, depending on your not understanding it, right? So, I mean, it's clear that you could be on one political party or the other, and you're basically given a list of beliefs that you're allowed to believe and espouse and vote for, and these ones you're not. I mean, just about. You have to play along party lines, basically. And then all of a sudden, your salary depends on it. You probably chose that party because those beliefs were more in line with what you had in the first place. But now it's literally you're dependent on it. Your identity is dependent on it. Let's not just talk about pay, right? Pay matters, but now your identity. You are so and so Republican, or you and so are so and so Democrat.
What box am I in?
Right, and and I would imagine like you can't just take every complicated issue that there is, put them into two boxes, yes or no, or true or false, and then line up lockstep with one group on every single one of them, right? So they probably all make compromises. Like,
yeah, of course they do.
I don't really believe that this is true, but for me to be so-and-so Republican, I have to. Or for me to be so-and-so Democrat,
well,
I have to.
You just tie it. You tie it to something else. That's how you justify it or rationalize it. Okay, I'll give here if I can get this issue.
Yep.
You know, it's tick-tack.
Yep. Yep.
But I think I want to tie it into what we got going on in society with George Floyd. I mean, that's an important
topic. This is the
topic.
Perfect example, too. Yeah.
Perfect. Because in order for Upton Sinclair's quote, again, he's a big fan of mine, he said getting the man to understand something's tough when his paycheck depends on him not understanding it. And I would say the prerequisite to that, the easiest way to not understand something is to not acknowledge it.
Yes.
To not, yes. Even if it's out there, I'm not going to follow those media channels or those stories. I'm not going to listen at all for one second to an argument that I think is outside of my system or my party or my identity. That's the easiest way, is to ignore.
The article in which I came across this idea of psychological resistance talked about a book called The Basic Neurosis, written by Edmund Bergler. And this guy, who is a psychologist, said one of his psychologist friends gave him the book. He started reading it. He was very uncomfortable with the ideas in the book. And he said he read like 5 or 6 pages and he put it aside. And it was only months later that he realized that he hid the book from himself. He didn't want to learn what it insisted was true. And unconsciously, we are doing that. All the time.
Yeah. And I don't even think – yeah, I think that's a good word. I don't think it's like strategic in our mind. Oh, this argument's wrong. I'm not going to look at it. It's something more innate. I think it's something more primal. Like we're just like, yep, nope, not on my radar, not in my comfort zone.
You know, I notice this when I'm doing things in at my job and business. It's like I need to call. I just need to pick up the phone and call this person. But it like feels – my gut, I feel a little bit of nausea, fear. Like, I don't want to do that, you know?
You resist.
I don't want to hear.
You resist the necessary but difficult path, and we take the easy one of email.
It's like, I don't want to hear the no. I don't want to have the negative, you know, experience. And so I don't. So oftentimes I don't. I put it off. I'll do it later. And then it never happens.
And I think that's what's going on in society, is we've got a whole group, a whole community, communities of people, specifically black people, that are just – they're done. They're done with how they feel and how many people have seen they've now been treated by police in many instances. Of course, let's throw it out. We're not here saying all police are bad.
Absolutely
we
not.
Need police. We need law. We need order. What I think we need is better relationships between the police and the communities they serve, both white and black, specifically black for this. But what we're seeing is – people are not – they're sick. They're tired. They're resisting the injustices of someone who's paid using taxpayer money, who's supposed to serve and protect their communities, and people feel threatened by those very figures, authority figures. That's scary as fuck. And they're sick and tired of being ignored and being treated as second-class citizens. And that's why we're seeing what I love on TV is all the protests, like fantastic. Now, the violence that accompanies it, and both from the perpetrators, the citizens, and from the police response to it, that is not what I like seeing. That's a cancer that's eating away at the patient of protest.
This is such a complex topic.
Yeah.
And what you see, right? So from people who don't want to acknowledge that this is, that there is truth to the fact that black people are, you know, overly oppressed. They are not treated fairly. They are not treated right by the police as a whole, right? That's what I think our whole country is trying to deal with. And I think people will latch on. People who don't want to accept that as a truth will latch on to anything they can to try and help them feel comfortable with not recognizing that as a truth.
So my next point. So the first one is with the George Floyd. We got people resisting injustice, resisting being ignored. We have other groups of people who feel they might have some power or privilege, being white people or whatnot, that are joining in that. And they're fighting. I think in their views, they're trying to give a voice to people who feel they might not have one, or at least to show solidarity. But to get at Dave's point, you have other people resisting acknowledgement of what's going on as a problem, because that it forces them to bump into these ideas that are uncomfortable, to maybe think about, am I in a bubble? Am I in a comfort bubble in my little Webster Groves community with safety and where I can do whatever I want within the law and walk up and down the street and feel totally fine?
Right.
Yes, I am.
The 100%. Status quo is great for me. So why do I want to change the status quo?
Right.
That brings uncertainty.
Yes.
That brings the possibility that things might not be as good and protective for me and my family in the future.
Yes.
And so if I just ignore it, I get to keep the status quo.
Yes. I just want to close my – it's ostrich syndrome.
Yeah.
It's perfect. The key word, I like my status quo. We don't want to acknowledge that other people's just daily lives, their status quo sucks in our own communities. Again, not everyone's, but a big chunk. We're seeing it on TV. And so my goal is I want to understand their status quo more. Like, I can't feel that way. I'm a white guy. So my positionality, I am unable to fully what I call absolute empathy. That doesn't exist. So all I can have is partial empathy. And the only way I can get that is with talking to people and trying to figure it out, both the cops and the people who feel misrepresented and overlooked.
Yes. Empathy of both sides and true understanding. We're talking about resistance, and I would just say the first step for anyone who wants to come to a full understanding of this is to recognize the resistance that you feel inside. It doesn't matter which side you want to take. Understand the negative emotion when you entertain the opposing ideas, when you entertain the opposing thoughts. Feel that negativity, recognize it, and try to overcome it. It is resistance.
Protest is the perfect idea and form of resistance, and Gandhi, you know, really made that famous, the civil disobedience, of which MLK studied and brought that to America and did the same thing. Protest is about raising public awareness of these uncomfortable truths for groups of people. It's about making the people in power, however you define it, uncomfortable. And that is happening. It is about hopefully getting regular folks like us to say, okay, is this something that we need to do something about? And if so, what do we need to do? How do we do it? And I think that's where I see in our friend group and family groups, I think people do care, but they feel a lack of traction for what they can do beyond, you know, changing a Facebook picture or donating to a cause that you don't know much about or things like that. Those are still important actions, and people should do those. But I think people want to have opportunities to take more direct action, but they don't know what those are.
Oh, yeah. I agree 100%. That's a really good point, and I want to revisit that. People want to have opportunities to take direct action, but they don't know what those are. And I'll just say this. When people are trying to come to grips with their understanding of these very complex topics, and like I said, you know, whichever side they want to be on, it's very easy for them to feel negative emotions when entertaining the other side's arguments and therefore ignore them, right? So just like the Upton Sinclair quote, it's really hard to get you to understand both sides, because one side you're going to be incentivized not to, because it goes against your interests, really, your, you know, motivations. And so, but to truly have a good understanding of this, I think it is your personal responsibility to try to educate yourselves on both sides, to recognize points that make you feel negative emotion, and at least, you know, mentally explore them, you know?
I've got some good points that I'm sure many white Americans are thinking in their heads, and potentially rightfully so. I live in a community, and this is hypothetical, I live in a community where there are no black people in my community. There are no people of color, of any color other than white, which is a color. That's funny. In my community. So these issues aren't in my day-to-day life. They're not part of my children's school lives, my work life, my social life. Why should I care? And I don't necessarily have a great answer to that outside of love, unity, understanding. We're a stronger country when we pay attention to those with the least power.
And I would say inspect the most people in those communities probably give to charities.
Yeah, well, 100%.
Probably do some volunteer work.
Yeah, I'm not judging those. I'm saying that's a – I'd probably think that if I lived in a small town.
And so all I'm saying is those – inspect the charities and the volunteering that you're giving to and ask yourself that same question. Is this charity or is this volunteer thing that I'm giving to a real problem in my own community? Or am I going out of my way to try to benefit a situation that does, that actually isn't a problem in my community?
Well,
and
I think
why wouldn't this issue be on that list of things that I donate to, that I volunteer
for? Well,
a lot of
things I do is volunteer work, but it revolves around things that my kids are involved with, their schools and whatnot. And that's charity. That's philanthropy. But that's also me, you know, doing stuff to make sure my kids are doing well. And you got to be honest about that. And there's real ego there. C.S. Lewis, famous English author. I mean, he's got some great quotes about charity. But paraphrasing him, if our charities and our philanthropy don't pinch our time, our pocketbooks, or our calendar, we're giving too little. Like, if we can do the same things that we normally do, the same vacations, the same frequency of vacations, enjoy the same food that we eat all the time, attend the same events that we do. Like, if we're not changing anything, his view is that there's no rule for how much somebody should give, but the only guideline is if your life hasn't changed at all for somebody with your equal level of income, you're giving too little.
Yeah.
Of your time, your knowledge. To me, it's all about the time giving on this one. The money is going to be the easy thing I think people will do in this situation. The more difficult and taboo a situation is to talk about face-to-face, I'm sure there's studies out there with philanthropic giving. I bet those are easier to collect money for.
Oh, I guarantee, because I can separate myself from my dollars.
Right. I gave.
Yeah. But what will my coworkers think about me if I tell them that I went down to the protest?
Or if I talk to somebody, what am I going to say? Like, where am I going to find some – if I'm in that community where there are no people of color, black people, Indian people, whatever, if I want to understand them, how do I do that?
How does that fit in with my identity?
Yeah.
And it's such a controversial thing. Right? Like, I don't want to ruffle feathers in the power structures that I am in. I don't want to
now
jeopardize my ability to.
I'll tell you, this is a side note that's tied into this. And so after the Michael Brown situation in St. Louis, Ferguson, 6 years ago, where he was shot and killed, and it tied into an issue with the prosecutor. A lot of people felt he should have recused himself, et cetera, et cetera. It was just, there was so much complexity going on at that time. So with that situation, I wanted to do something. And I always think, what is my unique ability to contribute? Every human being on this planet has, you know, some people call them your gift, your superpower. I like the idea, everyone has a unique ability to contribute. And it doesn't matter, it could be dollars, it could be, you're really fast. Great. Go organize a race for kids. Like, it doesn't matter. You can find what you're good at and do something with it. And so I'm kind of good at this communication, mediation, facilitation stuff. So I'm like, how can I get involved with that? Well, I started talking about that with people who are kind of in the know and were organizing things. And they're like, hey, we're doing focus groups in predominantly black neighborhoods to understand their relationship and perception of the police and just race relations. And we need facilitators. So talk about an intense facilitation. So I did that. Well, fantastic. I just learned so much in general about people. But I also learned about the manipulative side. Shame on me for not investigating what organization was behind doing this, which was an organization called Better Together, which was all about uniting the city and the county, which I actually agreed with. But at the time, they hid all that, and they didn't make it known that that was their agenda, which it was. And they're like, we're just here to understand and collect data and gather data and make a powerful dent in this situation. And I didn't, I was so excited at the idea of me getting to hear from people. And I love that face-to-face, difficult, direct communication. And it was powerful. And I'm so glad I did it. But looking back, I feel like they duped all the early people on that were helping collect the data to help them build their argument for what they wanted to eventually do politically and structurally, which I actually do agree with, but I do not like how they went about it. And I can see why they failed, because they
obfuscated their motivation.
They abused it. Yeah, they manipulated. But doing that, going into communities where I felt uncomfortable, where I was 100% the minority, facilitating these conversations, lots of learning, lots of self-discovery and interrogation, and being on point and really thinking through other people's ideas. But the most important thing I learned is, folks, they're people. They want this. Black people and white people want the same things: opportunities to get ahead, goals that they want to set and be able to achieve, safety for themselves and their family, decent food to eat. We like music, different types of music potentially. We all want to feel good. We want to put more checks in the feel good column than the feel bad column.
You know, you reminded me of a Joe Rogan podcast with Michael Wood Jr. He's a Baltimore police officer who makes exactly the case that you're talking about. I recommend anybody listen to it. This was done years ago. I think it was maybe after the Mike Brown incident. It was done. This one is in 2015, which I think might have been around that
Michael
time.
Brown was 2014.
Okay, so this was after the Mike Brown incident. And this police officer does a great job of explaining both sides. And I feel like I recommend folks listen to it. But he makes the point that you said, right? Which is, as a police officer, this is drawn up as an us and them type thing, as a war against the police and the people on the streets, the gang members, the whatever, you know, whatever you want to point them, call out to justify that there needs to be a war. And his point was, it doesn't need it, as a matter of, it should be the opposite. It shouldn't be a war. It should be working together to overcome this situation.
But even in real war, military war, U.S. versus whoever, they eventually end. Even when they're really long, they eventually end. And shit changes and people just get worn out. This one hasn't. It's been going on for quite many, many, many decades. I mean, how long was the war in Afghanistan? I think that's the longest war the U.S. was ever a part of. Look that up real quick. I think it's like 18 years or 22 years. I mean, it's a long time. 18, I'm guessing. What do we got? Afghanistan war.
I'm not getting.
Yeah, that's okay. But this one, we can't. When we use that language of we're at war, and I get it can feel like that, but then building that reality of, yeah, I'm going to work to not defend. It's almost like at that point, you're defending and protecting yourself, and not the community that you've been hired to serve as a. I mean, those aren't police civil servants. They're there to serve. And again, right. Most police do that. Right. Most very well. Right. Do their job excellently. But the ones that don't, of course, our media throws that out there, and rightfully so. People who have positions of power and abuse that power whether it's police because they have guns, or it's priests doing the pedophilia shit with kids. That's wrong. There couldn't be a greater injustice of taking a true position of authority that should be respected and honorable and have a sense of duty about what's going on, and you use that against the people you're supposed to serve. There's nothing more despicable in my book than that.
Yeah. Or our justice system. Or, I mean, there's a million examples we can give. So two quick things. Number one, war in Afghanistan, 21 years.
21?
Still going on, man.
It's still going?
We still have forces there. 1999 to 2020.
Wow. And that is just changing what we even think about war. It's just like, oh, yeah, we're still at war.
Yeah, it'll never – well, it's still going on, right? The other thing I wanted to mention was what you talked about, which is intention. Basically, the idea that if the ends justify the means, when you were talking about better together – and the fact that they were using shady tactics to gather data to push an agenda, which was to merge St. Louis City and County, which is actually something that you and I both agreed with and pulled for 100%. And really hope happened.
Absolutely.
But the way they went about it
made me bitter. And I even agree with a fair amount of the politics of the guy backing it.
Well, and even if you think about it, if St. Louis City and County merged, it would be better for black communities because resources that the county has would be shared with the city and it would lift everyone up.
And I think that that's well known among many groups of people that are against it.
I know.
You know, one of the arguments against it is simply their problems aren't my problems. Period. That's just bluntly it. That was learned in the data. And I don't want the city problems. Okay, well, that can mean a lot of things. But it can mean I don't want black people problems.
It's an us and them.
Yeah.
It boils everything down to us and them. It's the same thing as not wanting universal health care. Right?
But my point with that, and this does tie into this resistance, the city and the county, St. Louis is the only major metropolitan area of that city in the United States of that size that is not part of a greater county. It's the only one. And that happened during the Civil War era. And we have not found a way to unite it because really the county – municipalities, the 92 county municipalities, mayors don't want that. That's a power game. I get that.
Obviously, most of their jobs would go out of business. It would dissolve those municipalities.
But think if St. Louis all of a sudden was just this one big area, like every other major city in the U.S., it changes the story of St. Louis. Like, how do we not want that city to thrive? And instantly the crime stats change.
I was going to say statistics.
Like literally they change because of how they do the crime stats.
It would go from a city of 300 and something thousand to 1.1 million overnight. You know, the 52nd largest city in the country to the 20th.
Well, and the stories, like a crime occurs and they're like, oh, St. Louis, it's at number two most dangerous city. Okay, that same crime occurs. Is it even news if we're 130th on the list?
Yeah.
No, it's not. And that begins to change the city.
Yeah.
Story.
Yeah. It would like the most dangerous statistics would go from whatever top five, you know, to like 50th.
But again, this is a tough conversation because people it's all in the methodology and measurement calculations for how the stats are created.
And so we're talking about resistance here.
Listen to this. Yeah, we resist.
Listen to the resistances everywhere from opposing forces, right? So in this complex situation that we are just describing that Zach experienced, you had a group called Better Together who wanted to unite the city and the county.
To do what their title was, be better together.
Which would ultimately help people of color by sharing resources that the more wealthy county has with the more impoverished parts of the city have. They would share resources. It would lift up the most impoverished people.
Well, and it would reduce all – the guy behind it wasn't doing it for that, I don't think. He's doing it from purely economic and efficiency standpoint, reduce all these redundancies and the red tape.
Right. That actually would probably just be a side effect. The real motivation behind that organization to do that is to attract companies to St. Louis.
Yes, it's dollars. And that's okay. That's a good thing. Like as a consultant or as a contract, you're a subcontractor and you do work around St. Louis. You technically are supposed to have licensure in 92 different municipalities That's how it's supposed to work.
Yeah,
it's insane.
It's crazy. So obviously that would be a good thing if it happened, right? But the motivation for them creating these groups to quote unquote gather information about Mike Brown and the relationships between the police and the community was to gather data to support an agenda that would only be revealed later,
right,
to unite the city and the county for obvious economic and monetary purposes.
Right. And shame on me for not investigating. I'm not putting off my blame. That was my fault because I just saw my ego was like, yes, I get to do something I really enjoy and have these tough conversations, lead these tough conversations. And I mean, I had to go – wrong words. I chose to go and I led a conversation with a group of – transsexual teens of color. Zach, white guy from Belleville, with 20 teens across the spectrum of sexuality talking about their struggles on a daily basis. I can't empathize at all. I don't have those experiences. And I just was there to help them talk about very difficult conversations. Very enlightening. Did I agree with everything I heard? Of course not. Definitely not. That's okay. I learned about what they believe their struggles are and why they're valid. And it's okay if I don't agree with them all, but I at least have a better understanding and some knowledge of what they experience. That benefits me.
That is an amazing experience. And so for me to close the loop, what I would say is I started off by saying people who don't want to understand this topic from the other side, they look at whatever it is and they latch on to something like, oh, well, the protests just devolve into riots. Mm-hmm. So the protesters are clearly animals and they're wrong and whatever, right?
Just calling it a riot versus a protest.
Yeah, exactly. And when really the situation is complicated and nuanced, and you have to understand that there are forces from competing systems that are bumping up against each other and, you know, the causes cause versus correlation in all of these instances is so sophisticated and so complex. It's not fair to take any one of these occurrences and use it to justify your staunch position on one side or the other. Because as complex as the thing that Zach just talked about, his experience with his volunteering to be a mediator after the Michael Brown incident, as complex as that all was, trying to break down what the motivations were between the sponsoring body and the community and how there was manipulation involved, imagine that times 100. That's what's going on in our country right now when it comes to the entire Black Lives Matter
situation. Well, and it's easy to not listen if you live in a community that where those folks don't live there. I mean, you know, you can't mandate as a government, or I'm sure there are people that do believe that you could and should. You can't force people to go out and live somewhere else, or force them to go out and have a – everyone must have one conversation with somebody different. You know, you can't do those kinds of things. But I don't think you need to mandate integrity, and nor do I think governments can. I think every man and woman can look inside themselves and say, do I value freedom? If I do, I also – need to recognize that the other side of that coin is responsibility. So what is my responsibility to understanding a large group of people if they feel that people hired to protect them are doing the opposite? Shit, maybe I have a duty to at least try to understand that from their perspective. And then maybe you'll learn you disagree. And maybe you have better reasons for disagreeing and it strengthens your argument. That's one thing that happens when you stop resisting listening. It doesn't mean you're going to agree. And I think there's where a lot of fear is. It actually can mean you're going to strengthen your beliefs, and that's okay. And you'll probably actually have better evidence to back up why you believe what you believe. But you're not going to get there until you listen and investigate your own emotions.
That was awesome. I love the way that you explained that.
How it is. Like, you know, you've been working on listening for the last year and huge improvements. Your words, not mine. It changes things when you actually pause your emotions and say, help me understand what you think. And listen without listening to break down like an attorney does, not in a bad way. That's what they're trained to do. But listen to understand.
It's hard.
Mm. I think it's the hardest thing we have as humans in the society that we live in. It's not rewarded. Listening isn't rewarded and incentivized.
There is a resistance within you. There is a tendency to want to feel the emotional rush of being on the right side. And you have to overcome that. You have to resist that.
Here's what I also, so I'm ready, unless you have other key thoughts, I think we could throw some change challenges out because we're at like an hour-ish. Unless you have other key big ideas, feel free to keep going.
I don't. I just wanted to close the loop and point out some of the important things that you said in that last piece, which was basically taking your head out of the sand. Don't be the ostrich. Listen. Clearly, whenever something like this is going on, it's a sign that things aren't right. It's a sign that there's a problem.
This is called an indicator, a trigger, a symbol. There's something happening.
And so all we are trying to advocate for, all that I'm trying to advocate for, is overcoming the resistance within to try to come to a greater understanding of the world in which you live. I would think that most people listening to this would, if they ask themselves the question, would I want to live in a better world? Would I want my country to be a better country? Everyone's going to say yes to that. What that means to you, you have to internalize and you have to decide. But you can't do that if you don't explore what is going on. You don't explore the problem. You don't try to look at multiple sides of it and explore the things that make you feel uncomfortable and truly entertain them and ask yourself, what if that's really true? What if I was this other person? You know, and wherever you end up, that's personal to you. But
yeah,
you have to do it. It's you know what? I was going to say it's your responsibility to yourself to do it. But honestly, it's more than that. It's your responsibility.
It is your responsibility. It's everyone's. Yes. The smallest minority is the individual. And even when you're out marching with a large group of people, you're in a collective, you're in a mass, but in something it breaks down and the violence starts, right? The smallest minority isn't the black people there or the Indians there or et cetera. It's each individual and what you choose to do or not do in those situations. And then the same with the police. I do think we need to point out real quick before change challenges is the media. I don't care your politics. You choose to watch Fox, you choose to watch CNN or MSNBC, or you try to seek out more alternative sources, which I would encourage you to do that. You're on Twitter, you're on Facebook, so it's just nonstop. Man, there's just so much negativity, but it's because there's something going on out there. So when you're trying to think about sides and choosing and resisting, you don't have to just choose those sides that are being drawn up for you. Because let's be very clear. There are sides being very clearly curated for Americans to take in this. Don't blame the groups of people, whether it's the police or people in the black community, for those sides. That's going on a much bigger political level. So if you disagree with the framing of these stories, what gets showed, what doesn't get showed, get better media sources. Or better yet, drop them all and go have real conversations with real humans face-to-face on your own. Get primary data. Don't rely on mediated screen data to form important beliefs that you might have. Go talk.
So basically, don't be lazy. Be a real adult. Don't look for someone else to be your patriarchal daddy figure to tell you what it is that you should believe.
Thanks, CNN. Thanks, Fox. I've got a good talking point to repeat.
I mean, honestly, that is probably some of the best advice that we could give anybody, is go out and have firsthand experiences yourself. This will never happen. That nothing will change. Nothing will improve without people having firsthand experiences themselves. Because it's become clear in this country that depending on what media source you like to consume, you are being force-fed agenda.
It's literally become an echo chamber driven by artificial intelligence, machine learning, and algorithms. That's all you're going to see is whatever you're giving your little likes to. You're just going to see more of that.
You know, at the very basic, if you're like, well, I'm not willing to do that. I don't have the time to do that. And blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. At least open up the known opposing media sources and juxtapose the headlines and the stories that you are reading. That's the most basic thing that you can do, you know? But even better than that, because here's the problem with doing either of those things, is you're getting extreme one side, an extreme other side, And then you have to try to formulate middle on your own.
Right.
Right? Which, I mean, it's hard to do. It's hard because, it, like, I'm sure if you look at the psychology of it, there is something rewarding to taking a side and feeling part of a tribe. I'm team blue. I'm
well, that's,
team
that's
red.
That's the belonging. All humans want to belong to something bigger and greater and important.
When what we're talking about is so complex and so nuanced that they're like, just like we talked about with not being able to buy a set of 50 beliefs on one side and 50 on the other, because as an individual, you probably don't believe all 50 things that that side is selling. This is as complex as that or more, and you need to get out and interact with people who have different viewpoints and different experiences of your own so that you can formulate your own thoughts, your own experiences on which to base what you think is true.
Nice. I love it. The best thing I did when I was out the other night was simply just because I wanted to go out and just see, well, what's going on. I didn't want to form my opinion through what journalists or media figures are telling me is going on. I wanted to see it. And so when I was down there, my only goal, I met up with a friend, was to talk to a couple people and ask one question. What brings you out here today? I asked like five people and it was cool. It was different responses. And it's okay if you get down to a spot like, and I get it if you don't want to go do that because you fear for safety in terms of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Okay. But try to ask people like, what are your thoughts on this? And you don't have to have yours formulated. You can be doing that just as a part of your discovery phase, part of your data collection phase. And the other cool thing is it's okay if your beliefs evolve over time. That's like, what does it matter? When you're dead, when you're dying, guess what, folks? Your beliefs don't matter for shit. All that matters is the actions you took in your life. You could believe all kinds of crazy nonsensical shit that nobody would have ever known. But they do know the actions you took and the results that came from that. And that's what gets remembered, not what you believe, unless you write it down and publish it and throw it out there.
And it's those actions. And those actions don't have to be over the top.
Simple. Small, low risk actions.
Just imagine, what if Zach just asking people, what brings you out here today? What if that show, wait a minute, there are people out there who care, right? I came down to this protest because I was feeling despair that nobody cared about me and that my voice meant nothing. And I just got solicited by a stranger to know why I'm here, to know what my experience is.
It was cool. Yeah, people's answers were legit. I don't need to bring them up on the air, but they were people had real experiences that they were tied to with what was going on, and they care. They wanted to see positive change.
Bottom line is, we advocate making yourself uncomfortable through change challenges on every episode. To do things in the area that we've talked about today, resist. It requires discomfort. Get used to it. It'll make you a better
person.
Here's
the easiest change challenge. The easiest and the simplest and the most difficult. What are you resisting and why? Are you resisting even bumping into what's going on in this country? Okay. Admit that to yourself. And come out and just be like, I love the community I live in. These things aren't important to me. Okay. Hey, you know what? That's raw. And I can respect that you're so honest. Good for you. You are at least honest with yourself about what's going on. But that's just tough for a lot of people to get there.
We always talk about the
because then the morality comes in, the good and the bad judgments.
Yeah, well, we always talk about the deathbed test. And I think this is a perfect example of it. You know, there will be a day when you look back upon your life and the extreme situations, the extreme good, the extreme bad, the justices and injustices, the things that you wanted to fight for and the things that you didn't want to fight for, you're going to look back and you're going to judge yourself on those things.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Well, I think we gave you some good change challenges. This has been a fun topic. We started and an important topic, but I would say fun, probably not the best word, emotionally invigorating topic. And we started with, we're born into a world where we naturally resist, and our resistance is like a tension. Think of it like a big rubber band. There's more slack at times, and other times it's more tense. Well, if you pull that too tight, it's going to snap. And I don't think we're quite there yet as a country, but if we don't begin to dig in and listen and try to understand, we're going to have a big snap, even bigger than we've had now.
Agreed, 100%.
Cool. Well, thanks for listening. Hopefully you get something out of this. You can interrogate your own actions or inactions, beliefs or non-beliefs, and learn something about yourself and learn something about you, what you believe about this country and the direction it should head. So as we say at Life Lab, experiment with life.